The following podcast contains strong language.
When I first became nervous was when I got a phone call from the Washington Post who said, "Did you know that your media release resulted in a 9% drop in Whitehaven Coal's share price?" And that's when I thought, this could get interesting. And that's when I started to become nervous.
I'm Sarah McVee, and this is How Do You Sleep at Night? It's a show about people who live their lives in the face of judgment. It's about their moral codes and their definitions of right and wrong.
Well, it'll be remembered as one of Australia's most famous corporate hoaxes. Anti-coal activist Jonathan Moylan knocked up a fake press release from the ANZ Bank, which said the bank was cancelling a $1 billion loan to Whitehaven Coal for its new mining project because the bank was worried about the impact on the environment.
You light the blue touch paper and the whole box of crackers goes off.
In this episode, we go deep into the Laird State Forest in northwestern New South Wales. Jonathan Moylan was camping there when he sent the email that led to $300 million being wiped from the value of Whitehaven Coal.
The fact that it's grossly illegal, the fact that it cost a lot of people money and hurt a lot of mum and dad investors, that's quite upsetting that someone thinks that it's fun to do something like that as a plaything.
Do you think he thought about the impact that it would have on people that had invested in Whitehaven?
Yes, I do. I believe that was the point of his job.
Shareholders in these companies run the full gamut of Australian society.
Carrington Clark is a business reporter at the ABC. He says Jonathan's hoax didn't just impact the big end of town.
And because of the superannuation system, almost all Australians have some exposure to most large companies in the country, which means that when you have big fluctuations in the price or big losses, that affects us all.
Jonathan Moylan's hoax has been described as reckless and sinister. So what made him do it? And almost 5 years on, how does he feel about it now? Is he sorry that people who had no choice in the matter lost retirement savings because of him?
For most people's superannuation, you're not actively choosing when to buy and sell your shares. You're relying on experts in the market.
We're driving through the Hunter Valley west of Newcastle. In front of me, I can see giant smokestacks. There are open-cut coal mines in almost every direction.
I grew up in Newcastle. It's the second largest city in New South Wales, also the world's largest coal port.
Were your parents environmentalists?
I don't think they would say that, no. You know, they wouldn't walk down the street with placards or what have you, but they were certainly interested in the world and you know, knew when things were unfair, and that was instilled in me as well when I was younger. So I used to ride my bike to school, usually stopped halfway at a park with a bubbler, had a drink of water before I kept going, and one day the water was dirty. It was coming out brown, so as an 8-year-old I thought, you know, we can't have dirty water, people have to drink this, so I'm going to write a letter to the mayor. And I wrote a letter to the mayor asking if he could fix the problem. And he wrote me back a letter about a week later saying that it wasn't really his department, but that he would take care of it personally. And he thanked me for his letter. And a couple of weeks later, the water was fixed. So I guess maybe that was my first experience of creating change in the world.
When did you become radicalised?
I don't think I ever became radicalised. My concern's always been about people, and I became concerned about the global impact of coal exports when I found out about, you know, the potential for hundreds of millions of people to be displaced due to extreme weather events, and also from having seen in the Hunter Valley communities like Wybong and Ravensworth and Mount Thorley being displaced by rapid open-cut coal mining. You know, it wasn't that long ago that there was only 18 million tonnes of coal going out of the Port of Newcastle. Now it's about 162, and you can see the scale of that impact on the valley floor, with a third of the land between Singleton and Musselbrook transformed into massive open cut scars where once there were healthy and thriving communities.
When was the first time you got arrested?
First time I was arrested was at the construction site of the third coal terminal on Kooragang Island. There were about 50 of us who walked on to that site, and we stayed there for several hours until the police told us that we were under arrest, and then we walked with them to the police car and we were arrested for trespass.
How old were you?
I was 19.
And how many times have you been arrested since then?
I've probably been arrested about a dozen times. The last time would have been 6 years ago. So it's not something that I've ever done lightly, but it's something that I've done when, you know, other avenues to create change have failed. We're getting close to the Maules Creek mine, but we've entered the Laird State Forest. This is a public state forest, but it's close to the public because it's being dug out by a private coal mining company.
Do they have like a Jonathan Moylan radar around here?
I don't think so. So I first came here in April 2012. We were living in a small camp with bird noise and the occasional goanna that slithered into camp and lived around a campfire, and people were dropping in almost every day.
This was the beginning of the Maules Creek blockade. At first it was just Jono and his mate Muzz camping in the bush, but eventually it grew to a fully fledged protest movement against Whitehaven's plans to build a coal mine here.
Hundreds of people came and put their bodies on the line to stop the expansion of the mine and the destruction of the Laird State Forest.
One of those people was Wallabies star David Pocock.
Pocock was one of nine protesters who yesterday chained themselves to excavators at the Maules Creek mine site near Narrabri. The 26-year-old was on the equipment for 10 hours before being arrested and charged.
Did you chain yourself to a bulldozer?
I didn't chain myself to a bulldozer here. At the time that I was here, I was on a good behaviour bond and not able to get arrested, but I was able to be part of a community. There's always somebody that needs to stay at camp and do the dishes.
Did you feel comfortable not locking yourself on when there were other people doing that?
In any kind of action, there are lots of different roles that people need to play.
We've just arrived at Cliff's house. When Jono and the other protesters got kicked out of the Laird State Forest, they came here to camp. Cliff's in his late 60s. He's a farmer. He speaks softly but very directly.
I've never seen a dog eat so much cow shit. Most of them just have a couple of licks. She's then there's the next. She's just gorgeous and stuff.
The house is small and there's a corrugated iron shed next to the house that says, in painted letters on the side of it, "You're welcome to borrow things from the shed, but fucking put them back." Tell me what he was like when he got out here.
Jono, he was absolutely useless. He couldn't do a damn thing except for one thing, and he was excellent at it.
What was it?
Argue against me. All my ideas were no good. And I thought all his ideas were no good. We wound up the best of mates. That'd be right, Jono.
Cliff has made a campfire for us and the sweetest instant black coffee I've ever drunk. His old Kelpie charcoal is sitting patiently in the ute. His pup, Tanya, is begging Cliff for some of his buttery bread. Cliff tells me he's voted Conservative his whole life. He's the most unlikely activist you could meet. And until Jono showed up, he had no idea about running a protest.
Nothing to see six or eight police wagons at the front gate. One particular night, they had two riot squad vans up here, and there was a few of us out the front gate, a couple of young boys and a few girls. Anyway, they shined a spotlight on me, and I went and sat down, probably about 15 yards away from them. and sat in the chair, and then they shone the spotlight on me and sitting in the chair. So I went inside and got a blanket, got me dog, and I faced northwest. The dog on the left-hand side, he went to sleep. I went to sleep sitting up in a chair. 5 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, stood up and went to work. Cops learned out who was the tougher of the two. They couldn't keep me awake with a spotlight, boring my eyes out. Jackal had a good night's sleep too.
Why do you oppose the mine?
Because it's destroying the water supplies, it's destroying the atmosphere. We've stepped up the pace of digging coal out of the ground, and that's been burnt all the way around the world, so we have to be warming the world up.
The protests ultimately didn't stop the mine. In late 2012, Whitehaven got the go-ahead from the state government.
The only two legitimate options remaining were to try to get the federal environment minister, Tony Burke, to protect the critically endangered communities in the Laird State Forest, or to get the ANZ Bank to change its decision about financing the project. So the idea was to draw attention to the ANZ Bank's billion-dollar loan to the project.
Jonathan thought that if he drew attention to the ANZ's loan, it might embarrass them out of funding the project and stop the mine from going ahead.
How did you get the idea to send the fake press release?
Originally, the idea was to set up a website parodying ANZ, and then I realised that my web skills weren't that great, and that putting out a spoof press release would be an easier thing to do.
What did you write?
At the time, I announced on behalf of the bank, somewhat preemptively it seems, that the ANZ Bank had decided to withdraw its loan for Whitehaven Coal's Moores Creek coal project because of volatility in the global coal market, because of reputational risk, and because of the sensitive nature of the area and customer feedback.
I got a press release in my inbox. At that time, I was environment editor at the Sydney Morning Herald.
That's Ben Cubby. He was the first journalist to respond to Jonathan's press release.
So the ears pricked up, picked up the phone, rang up and had a chat to a person that I later found out was Jonathan Moylan.
So I did drama when I was a kid, and art and theatre have always been part of cultural activism. I thought I did a pretty good impersonation of a bank manager, and apparently I was right.
Did you feel guilty?
No.
He was very convincing on the phone. You know, I mean, it was an intriguing phone call because what they were saying was surprising, but it didn't initially cross my mind that he was pretending to be someone else.
I was posing as the sustainability director for ANZ Bank. I didn't have any concept of how that might impact on the share market.
In my opinion, he did the wrong thing because you have to act in good faith with people. And I think he's had to take that on the chin because there's been repercussions.
When I first became nervous was when I got a phone call from the Washington Post who said, "Did you know that your media release resulted in a 9% drop in Whitehaven Coal's share price?" And that's when I thought, this could get interesting. And that's when I started to become nervous. It was first on the ABC, on the 7:30 report. Greg Tanzer from ASIC was interviewed, and they said that they were taking the matter very seriously.
The penalties that apply here are really quite severe. There are thousands of Australian public companies that rely on the market to provide an efficient source of funds, and they employ, directly or indirectly, millions of Australians. And on top of that, there's many, many Australian superannuation funds that invest the retirement savings of millions of Australians.
The next day I got a missed call from ASIC, who asked if I could please return their call, if I wouldn't mind calling them up and having a chat. And they flew out to camp about 2 weeks later, so they took my computer and my phone away for imaging and recording and called me in for compulsory examination in Sydney.
What was it like to have ASIC show up at the Moores Creek camp?
I think they were interested. Muzz actually took them for a bit of a tour of the Laird State Forest. They were...
Are you serious?
Yeah, he did.
Jonathan was facing fines of up to nearly $500,000 and up to 10 years in jail.
What was it like to be under investigation?
I guess we all never know in this day and age of digital security and so on who might be listening in. So in some ways it was reassuring to have the certainty that I was being listened to. The most difficult thing about it was that for that entire period of time, I wasn't able to talk to anybody else about what was going on or really even how I felt about it. So that, you know, that was difficult, but anyway, that was part of the deal, I suppose.
Whitehaven's media guy said no to an interview. He sent me a statement saying they're proud that in the last 2 years, the mine has given more than 500 people highly paid jobs. And there is support for the mine in the area. A lot of people around here were pissed off by Jonathan and the other protesters. I've gatecrashed a regional business awards night in Gunnedah, which is about 50 k's from the mine.
My name is Jamie Chaffee and I'm the proud mayor of the Gunnedah Shire Council.
What impact do you think Whitehaven's had on this community?
What Whitehaven do for this region, it's enormous. Absolutely enormous. It's good for the town.
Is it going to last?
It's good for the youth as well. The jobs are there. Well, I think most of the mines that are here now at the moment have at least a 30-year mine life. What will happen after that, I'm not too sure. When activists come and they're destructive, or they're doing things that put other people's lives at risk, well then, you know, that just simply can't be tolerated.
Have you seen that happen in this community?
I have seen that happen, yes.
What kinds of things?
Oh, I've seen activists that have tied themselves to bulldozers and been under blades, you know. I've seen them actually tied to railway lines suspended on a viaduct in the air, you know, which then puts a lot of other people at risk that have to go and take them out of that situation.
G'day, my name's Murray. And
Murray's a local councillor and farmer, and he also works at Whitehaven. He's scathing about Jonathan's decision to break the law.
Did he physically attack someone and beat them up? No. Did he deliberately, willfully commit, you know, what turned out to be a fairly consequential crime? Yes. Punishment didn't fit it. I don't view what Jonathan's done any different to animal activists who step outside the boundaries and break laws to attack our farming community. And personally, that scares the hell out of me. And it's like being judge, jury and executioner, isn't it? You know, we have a court of law and a natural justice system. And, you know, when people try and take it in their own hands to act outside the law, he's essentially trying to be a vigilante. And realistically, it's the modern day equivalent of lynching someone that you think has committed a crime.
We're on a big hill looking over the Moores Creek coal mine. So you can see in front of us massive piles of overburden trucks shaping coal piles, the occasional big plume of dust. On the other side behind us is the farmlands in Moores Creek.
We're looking out over the Whitehaven open cut coal mine. Is that a sign that you failed?
I wanted to stop the expansion of this coal mine. We also had lots of different objectives. The campaign out at Moores Creek attracted hundreds of people from, you know, all walks of life, and it really, I think, built a much bigger movement to challenge the expansion of the coal industry everywhere else. Before we started this campaign, a lot of people thought about climate change. They were thinking about the effect that expanding the industry globally would have, but the actual impacts on communities living in the Hunter Valley and in the Northwest were essentially invisible. So that's one of the things that we were trying to do, and I think we achieved that.
Do you feel bad about the people that lost money?
We all have superannuation accounts and we all have bank accounts, and we may not know where our money is being invested, and some of the people who might have been affected by trades at a 9% lower value than otherwise would have been the case could have lost hundreds or even thousands of dollars on that day without even knowing about it, and they may still not know about it now. I put out a an apology letter that I was actually criticised for from both sides. People who were part of the campaign didn't like it because I expressed my regret for the impacts of my actions on people who have money invested on their behalf that can be invested in Whitehaven, and my lawyers didn't like it because I had failed to apologise to large institutional investors, and I think they're in a different category. The world in the future is going to look radically different if we don't move away from fossil fuels. We all know that those people who continue to make massive profits, although diminishing profits, in fossil fuels are affecting you, are affecting me, and are affecting everybody who's listening to this.
But what about the people that you talked about first, that you said sorry to? I just don't understand how you can know that they lost money, that they hadn't done anything wrong, and that they may not even know that they've taken big hits to their super, for example, and yet you still say that you are glad that you did what you did.
Although I didn't intend anybody to trade on the back of those statements, people were affected who weren't aware of where their investments were, and they do deserve an apology. And, you know, I think it's a really important part of any act of nonviolent civil disobedience is that you take responsibility for your own actions, but also that you are aware of and empathetic towards people who might be affected.
Is sorry enough?
Well, it clearly wasn't enough. I was under coercive investigation for 6 months. I was put on trial in the Supreme Court in the highest primary jurisdiction in the country. I was convicted of a serious federal offence. And given a 2-year suspended jail sentence, which if at any time during that 2 years I had crossed the street wrong, I would have been thrown in the slammer for 1 year and 8 months. I wish that the planet that we all share, that is integral to our own well-being and the well-being of our communities and our futures, had the same level of protection as a market that is designed to protect the interest to make profit. So I accept responsibility, and I wish that those on the other side would accept their share of responsibility as well.
Jonathan Moylan doesn't live in a tent in the forest anymore. He works in the city at Greenpeace, campaigning to stop banks from investing in new coal mines. These days, any press releases he writes are under his own name. Thank you so much for listening. Next time on How Do You Sleep at Night? The anti-abortion activists who pray out the front of clinics.
Are you like a priest? Because I see you here all the time with the most smug face.
Smug?
Find out why they do it when so many people wish they wouldn't. You can binge all 6 episodes right now on the new ABC Listen app, or you can hear 1 a week on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts.